When Danielle was 4 years old, she asked Martha, she said, "Do you ever get angry with your husband?" And Martha said, no, she didn't say it. She said, "Yes, I do from time to time." And Danielle said, "Well, yeah," she says, I sometimes get angry with my boyfriend too. I don't know about you, but in our house, we start the dating process really early, at the age of 4. Anger seems to be our national pastime, doesn't it? The FBI statistic says that every 20 seconds there's a violent crime committed in the United States. It's estimated that 2 million women will be battered and abused by their husbands this year. And as we look at the movies and the different genres that have come out over the last couple of decades, we recognize that we have spawned a whole new generation of heroes, Terminators and Rambos and people who have lethal weapons and people that die hard and, you know, just by and large, people that don't set a good example of anger management. Some people who have studied anger for years have begun to call our era the age of rage. One UCLA professor said that we have a reservoir of rage that exists in each one of us and is just waiting to burst out. Now, having said that as an introduction, what I'd like to do is now take a step back and put Jesus' comments in that introduction into context. I want to review just for a moment. Last week, we talked about the fact of Jesus' shocking statement when he said to the people and to us that unless their righteousness exceeds that of the Pharisees, they would never get into his kingdom. And the people were wondering about how that was going to be possible. Because the Pharisees were the world record holders in keeping the law and in world righteousness. A lot of people, when they look at this fifth chapter of Matthew, they look at it and they look at these particular passages and they think that Jesus is saying that the Old Testament is wrong. That's not what he's saying. What Jesus is saying is that the Pharisees' interpretation of the Old Testament was incomplete, that it was inaccurate, and in some cases, that it was wrong. Now, you need to know that when he said that, that would have been conceived or heard by the people as insanity. Certainly by his listeners and, of course, by the Pharisees. You see, the Pharisees, as I just said, they were considered the experts in the law and they were well respected in terms of understanding what the law said and how to apply it. So when Jesus says to them, to the people, well, the Pharisees misunderstood it, that would be like me telling Bill Gates, you don't have a clue about how to run a successful company. That'd be like you telling Paula Deen she's clueless in the kitchen. Jesus points out, though, that the reason why that they've made a mistake, and he says the mistake they've made is that the Pharisees have said that you can be righteous if all you do is just follow the letter of the law. Jesus says that's not true. You can follow the letter of the law and not like it. For example, you can pay your taxes, but not like it. Jesus says the law encompasses more than just the letter of the law. It encompasses also what's on the inside. Jesus says your inside has to match your outside. Your attitudes have to match your behavior. And that's where the Pharisees went wrong. They said, doesn't matter what you think on the inside. It's just if you do on the outside, that's okay. And so while the people are still sort of scratching their heads and in shock about what he said, he goes on and gives them 6 illustrations about how he rightfully would interpret the Old Testament law. And the first thing, the first illustration he comes to, the first passage here is that comes right out of the Ten Commandments. He says, do not murder. Now, when he's talking about murder here, he's talking about premeditated murder. He's not talking about killing or capital punishment or self-defense or anything like that. He's talking about premeditated murder. And that was a safe place for him to begin, I'm sure. You know, as he says that, the people, just like yourselves, are sitting there thinking, well, that's all right. He says, you know, I've never murdered anybody, and that seems, I'm fairly comfortable with what he's saying. That's a good teaching. You know, it's always nice when the preacher's talking about somebody else, isn't it? So Jesus begins by saying, you've heard it said, not taught, not written, you've heard it said by the Pharisees that you are not to murder. Now the reason, of course, that we're not supposed to murder is because all of us have been made in God's image. And therefore, because we've been created by God and made in His image, only God has the right to take somebody's life. He's the only one who has that right. But then Jesus says, you've heard it said that you're not allowed to murder, but I'm also saying that if you are angry with somebody, that also is murdering somebody. In other words, Jesus is saying, look, if the Jewish leaders are going to legislate against murder, then they also need, and make it a punishable offense, then they also need to legislate against anger, because anger is the motive for murder. You see, when we are angry with somebody, what we are trying to do, whether we do it consciously or unconsciously, we are trying to take their identity and take their value as a person who is made in the image of Christ or in the image of God. We're trying to take that away from them. And the most extreme form of that is the physical act of murder. Jesus is saying, look, if you want to avoid being a murderer, then you need to learn how to manage your anger appropriately. Now, I want to go down one side road here just for a minute or two to talk about anger. And I'm going to begin by asking you a question. What do you get when you breed Lassie with a pit bull? You get a dog that bites your face off and then runs for help. That's what you get. What does that have to do with anger? You see, a lot of Christians automatically assume that anger and the Christian faith cannot coexist, like Lassie and a pit bull. There's a lot of guilt around anger. But we need to understand for a moment that anger is a God-given emotion. And that's why we can't stop those feelings. We will always have angry feelings. That's what it is. Dr. Minnith and Carter, two psychologists, define anger as this, as an intent to preserve three things. One is our personal worth, two is our essential needs, and three is our basic convictions. And so when we get angry, that's usually what we're angry about, isn't it? One of those three things. And so, on the one hand, we need to understand that anger is a God-given emotion. But there's another side of it, and it's also a biochemical reaction. That God has instilled in all of us that anger is a biochemical reaction whenever we feel threatened or we feel attacked. Anybody who has a pet or an animal or watched any movies of that, understand that. That we are in the same way. And so while we recognize that it's impossible to ignore the feelings of anger, the difference comes in our reaction to and our handling of anger. We have a choice. We exercise our will in how we handle our anger. And anger crosses the line whether or not we are just angry and sin, or whether or not we are angry and do not sin, depends on how we handle it. We can be explosive in our anger. We can sort of nurse it along and hold it as a grudge. Or we can handle it in a positive way. That's why Paul says in Ephesians, he says, be angry, but don't sin. That's why also Jesus and Paul both recognize that it's okay to be angry. What's not okay is to be angry in a negative way. That's the side road. Now let's come back to the text. The Bible talks about two different kinds of anger. The one kind of anger is the explosive kind of anger. It's described as rage. I'm sure a few of you know what I'm talking about. It's the kind of anger that explodes, it's rage. And when used in, of a person in the Bible, it is never seen in a positive light. This is the kind of anger that Paul talks about in Colossians 3:8. That he says, this is the kind of anger you need to get rid of and lose. It's never acceptable. Now, of course, the irony is I've had people say to me, when I've asked them, how do you deal with your anger? They say, I just get it all out. I just say whatever I'm going to say, and I just explode, and it's just out there, and I'm over. And I have to think to myself, I don't say this to them, but I'm thinking in my mind, yeah, you're over it, but have you bothered to look around at the body count of the people around you after you've exploded? The Bible says that kind of anger is never acceptable. There's a second kind of anger that Jesus is talking about, or the Bible talks about, and that is the enduring kind of anger. This is the kind where you have the slow burn, the kind that sort of you continue to feed by thinking about it. It's not any less intense, it's just directed maybe in a different way or expressed in a different way. The explosive anger is out there, and at least you do the one healthy thing in expressing it. You don't express it well, but you express it. The enduring kind of anger is usually expressed in a different way. Lots of times that's internalized. And so that kind of anger comes out in smoke and fumes like a critical spirit. Or maybe somebody becomes withdrawn. Or maybe they become depressed because depression is the flip side of anger. Or maybe they become everybody's favorite, somebody who's passive aggressive, so they make the other person feel crazy. Either kind of anger is inappropriate. The irony for the people that have the enduring kind of anger is they take pride in the fact that theirs is not explosive. You know, because they think the explosive kind of anger would be unchristian or unloving. There's nothing any more loving about the enduring kind of anger. It's how you express it that matters. Jesus says that when we get to that point where we're angry, when we want somebody out of our way and out of our life, he says we've crossed the line. In both of these kinds of anger, he's talking about anger about that we feel when somebody has attacked us. It's interesting, though, that Jesus doesn't stop just by linking anger with murder. He takes it one step further and he adds, if you would, insult to injury. He adds insults to that definition of what he considers, or God considers, murder. And he gives us two illustrations. He says, you know, if you're angry with somebody and you insult them, you say that they're stupid or you say that they're an idiot, then you have insulted their intelligence and you've crossed the line. You know, today when we hear that, we say, that's pretty tame stuff, honestly. I mean, when you're really angry with somebody, my guess is you use words that are far worse than idiot or stupid. Words that we can't print or say here. But in Jesus' day, that term raka was a sign of contempt, and it was a real strong personal insult. The second case he talks about is if you call somebody a fool. Now again, we think, what's so bad about that? But in Jesus' day, to call somebody a fool wasn't just casual slang. It wasn't just sort of a casual comment. You were talking about their character, their moral integrity. You were saying that they were morally and spiritually bankrupt. And so on the one hand, if you're going to insult somebody and you insult their intelligence, or on the other hand, you insult their character, Jesus says neither one is acceptable. And in God's eyes, both of them are the same as murder. Because God deals with the inside. He deals with your attitude, not just the letter of the law. Now the question is, why would Jesus include insults along with murder? I mean, I guarantee you, I don't, and my guess is you don't either. When we're insulting somebody, we don't even think of that as being murder. That's the farthest thing from our mind. So why would Jesus marry these two things? Well, understand that in the Jewish culture, name-calling was highly insulting because a person's identity is being defaced. It's being stripped away. When you're insulting somebody, you're taking their character, their intelligence, their dignity, and you're stripping it away and you're replacing it with something else. And in a culture, we can't relate to this because our names don't mean that much to us, quite honestly. But in a culture in which a name defined who you were, insulting them and their dignity was like stealing their identity. And Jesus is saying, if you're going to steal your identity, then that also is a form of stealing their life, which is murder. If any of you have ever suffered from or know somebody who's had been the victim of identity theft, you understand a little bit about what I'm talking about. In talking with people that get beyond that process, their comment, every single person, their comment is the same: I finally have my life back. See, they haven't just stolen your name. They've stolen your life. One of the striking things about this illustration is Jesus' emphasis on the dignity of the person who has been made in the image of God. Jesus says the sixth commandment about do not murder isn't just about the physical act of killing somebody. It also includes do not harm somebody's personal dignity, their integrity. So Jesus is saying, you know, look, if the murderer deserves to go to hell, then the mudslingers and the fire breathers, they need to go too. Because even though the act of murder may have and does have physical consequences, and in our own minds for here on earth, we think that those consequences are worse than just thinking about murder or being angry or insulting somebody else. In God's eyes, they're the same. Because the monitors, God's monitors, are on our heart, not on just the external actions. God deals with our motives. Now, some of you, I'm sure, would probably say, well, Jesus got angry, didn't he? The answer is yes, he did. Didn't Jesus call the Pharisees fools? Yes, he did. But there's a huge difference between Jesus' anger and our anger. Jesus got angry over injustice and sin. And that's why he was upset with the Pharisees. That's when he got upset. He wanted to correct that problem. When we get angry, usually it's over a personal attack. It's because our ego or our pride has been stepped on. There is a huge difference between when Jesus got angry and when we get angry. All you have to do is look at the cross and you can tell the difference. Being crucified wasn't any small thing, but you know what? Jesus never attacked the people. What did he do? He forgave them. Well, after Jesus has defined murder and added to it, then he also is kind enough to give us his solution to it. And he says, what are we supposed to do if we get to this point of being angry, or if we've crossed that line when we've insulted somebody? He says, what we are to do is we are to reconcile that relationship. And he gives us two examples of what he's talking about. He says, in the first example, if you're in church and you're about to put some money in the offering plate, he says, and you remember that you have offended somebody. The emphasis is on you. You have done something wrong. Not somebody else has done something to you, but you have done something wrong to somebody else. It is your responsibility to fix that. He says, don't sit in church and pretend that everything is fine. Don't sit there and sing hymns and pray and read and listen to the sermon, do all those kinds of things in the hope to cover up that broken relationship. He says, no. He says, you get up and you leave. Wait and see if anybody does. He gets up and leaves. He says, you get up and leave and go fix what is wrong. Understand the urgency there that Jesus talks about? He says it's better to keep God waiting and fix the relationship than to give your gift to God and act like nothing's wrong. That's what really righteousness is all about. It's about dealing with what we know is wrong and doing something about it. Reconciliation is important for two reasons. The first reason is because if you follow what the psalmist said in Psalm 66, we can't really worship God if we harbor sin in our heart, if we nurse that. We can't really worship God that way. And the second reason why we want to reconcile is because it reflects the character and the love of God to us. The second illustration that Jesus uses here, he says, not only are we to reconcile if there's a broken relationship if we're in church, but he says, we're also supposed to reconcile before they even get to the courts. In other words, if somebody has something against you, he says, you better make sure that you get that reconciled before you end up in jail. Because if it's about payment, paying somebody, when you're in jail, you can't pay them back. There's no way for you to pay them back. Back then, they had citizen's arrest. So if somebody caught you doing something illegal, they could drag your bones into the court. The judge could rule against you. You would be in jail. That would be the end of it. So Jesus, in both of these cases, he says there's a sense of urgency about reconciling that relationship. You see, keeping the sixth commandment is about far more than just not killing somebody. It's really about nurturing relationships. It's about reconciling ourselves with other people. Jesus is teaching us here about the importance of maintaining healthy relationships with others. He goes on and he says that anything that we do that strips away the dignity, the integrity of somebody else, that's sin. And it's our responsibility to heal that wound, to fix that problem to the best that we can. And the reason why we are to do that is because God calls us to live in harmony. He calls us to live in peace and in love with everyone else. He calls us to reflect His character to a broken and hurting world. And so think about that. The next time that you're angry and you go to open your mouth, remember that God, He sees your motives. And He's not going to let you get away with murder. Let's pray together.